This is Matthew Putman, and you are listening to Utility Function. If you've listened to Utility Function over the last year, you've noticed that we've spoken to a lot of different types of people from different disciplines. But one that seems to keep coming back are theoretical physicists. And today I had the chance to speak with Juan Martin Maldacena, who is certainly one that I would like to have had on this program. The great physicist Leonard Susskind called him perhaps the greatest physicist of his generation, and certainly the greatest theoretical physicist of his generation. He is the Carl P. Feinberg Professor in the School of Natural Sciences at the Institute of Advanced Study. Well, if you're familiar with the Institute of Advanced Study, it has a storied history that includes having Albert Einstein himself. In the past 2 years, he is doing research mainly on the description of black holes and string theory and its relationship of the large n limit of gauge theories in gravity. String theory is presently understood well enough to answer some of the puzzles of black hole physics. I really love this conversation. It digs deep into some technical areas, but also lets us know what it's like to be at one of the premier institutions doing some basic theoretical research. Well, great. Man, this is both an honor and scary.
It's a pleasure to be here, yeah.
All right. Well, you know, it means a lot to me that you came here. Are you right now in Princeton?
Yeah, I'm at the Institute, and the Institute is open. We can come here and with some social distancing and so on.
Well, it's one of the more interesting places to be always at Princeton, but you work at a place that's historically important. Can you talk about, you know, a place where, you know, Einstein and Gödel were, and now what is life like when you're doing research and you're trying to discover what the universe is mathematically? And
this is a place with a long history and a history of trying to find the fundamental laws of physics. I mean, much of the research here was in understanding the most basic laws. So I guess in the time of Einstein, he was thinking about the laws of space-time and trying to extend his, also thinking about quantum mechanics and so on. So his famous paper on EPR correlations, which talks about entanglement, which points out the property of entanglement in quantum physics he did while he was here. And then later, I guess, during the times of Oppenheimer, he invited many people that did lots of work in particle physics, like Young and Lee and so on. Now there is a group thinking about, many issues in formal particle physics, so understanding the theories that describe particle physics, which are called quantum field theories, and understanding these theories in general. Not necessarily for the specific matter content of a standard model, but in more generality, because it might be that there are other particles out there and one would like to understand what the general structure of these theories is. It's somewhat similar to the work that was done trying to understand classical mechanics in the far past. I mean, trying to understand the more general and simple description of mechanical systems was important after, you know, Newton had his laws. In the same way, now we are understanding quantum field theory, which is this synthesis between special relativity and quantum mechanics. And so that's one area. And the other area is understanding the quantum mechanics of gravity or the quantum mechanics of space-time. So how we should think of a space-time as a quantum object also. So we know matter we describe using quantum mechanics. But space-time, it's dynamical as the theory of Einstein. That should also have a quantum description, and we're trying to understand what that quantum description is.
Well, I want to get into some of these things and some of your ideas, but how much does atmosphere matter? I think a lot of this during COVID times,
right,
obviously.
Right.
We're communicating in a different way than we used to. seems to me that where you are, it's interesting. And, you know, sharing ideas and growing, how much does atmosphere matter? And
I think it's very important to discuss in person. More efficient, it's quicker, it's more motivating. I think we are used to discuss with people in person. So I think it's always better when you can discuss in person. But we managed to do reasonably well via Zoom. So it's not terrible. I mean, for other professions, it's much more difficult for other areas. But I think going in the future, I mean, I'm looking forward to having more in-person discussions.
Oh, God, yeah, me too. I want to come to Princeton, walk around and talk to you guys. I'd much rather be doing that than this way. But this is an opportunity that maybe we wouldn't have had.
Sure, yeah. Well, it also offers us new opportunities. So we have more discussions with people who are not here. So people are in other institutions. So in that way, it's been positive. So.
Can you tell me what it was like, you know, you grew up in Argentina, is that right?
Yeah.
Can you tell me what it was like to, you know, to be thinking about science, if you were, and what communication was like growing up?
So I really got interested first into technology, so understanding how various things work. And my father was, well, he's an engineer, and he liked fixing things in the house and, you know, fixing the washing machine, the car, etc. And I would help him, and I would learn about how technology works. And so that got me interested in the technology, and then into the laws of physics, of how things work, how electricity works, and so on. And when I was finishing high school, I was doubting between doing physics or engineering, and I decided to go into physics just to see what it was like. I think I didn't have so many popular science books as there are now. Maybe, well, at least that was my perception. Maybe there were many and I just didn't know about them. But I feel now there are many really good popular science books that you can learn a lot about science through them. Or of course, we have also many online things, videos, etc.
So without having that, making the transition from dealing with physical mechanics, you're taking something apart there. Yeah, you said you dig into electricity. How do you then move to electromagnetism? And you know, what inspired you then to step beyond what the observable was into something that is theoretical?
Well, I also always liked mathematics. So I like the mathematics of that we use in physics, and I like how this part of theoretical physics, which is, if you wish, is some kind of applied mathematics, but it's not very abstract mathematics, but it's mathematics applied to physical systems. So you can imagine what the system is doing, and this makes you think about some mathematical concepts and so on. So that's the aspect. That's why I like more theoretical physics than perhaps experiment. But of course, experiment is fun also.
Yeah, I mean, you're well known for being a great mathematician, but being a physicist is different. Did you consider being a mathematician?
Yeah, I did consider it. Yeah, but I liked more the, as I said, the applied aspect of physics.
I mean, I'm friends with Ed Frankel. Do you know Ed?
Yes.
Yeah. And Ed always talks about sort of wearing this different hat and jumping back and forth between a mathematical mindset is not always something that combines to be to apply to the universe. And sometimes it does.
Right.
Have you had an experience where something is incredibly elegant mathematically, but it was disappointing that it doesn't have a physical correlate?
Yes, I think. Well, in some sense, supersymmetry is a bit like this. I mean, supersymmetry could have explained why the value of the mass of the Higgs is so low. And it could have been discovered in the LHC, and it wasn't discovered in the LHC. In the LHC is the Large Hadron Collider, the collider in Geneva. Now, it could be that the supersymmetry is still there, and it is at higher energies, and maybe we'll discover it at some point. But
were the results of LHC experiments disappointing to you?
Well, I think I guess I would have liked the supersymmetry is a beautiful theoretical idea. If it had been discovered, it would have been great. But this is just the theorist's wish. I mean, the LHC was wonderful because it, you know, now we know what the truth is.
Yeah, I always find it fascinating to be able to explain why to people, and I can't explain it well, but some people do. I spend more time with physicists than I understand physics, right? The discovery of the Higgs is interesting. You know, the boson was interesting, but at the same time, it would have been even more exciting if it hadn't been in some regards.
Well, yeah, it would imply that the way we understand nature is wrong, and not discovering it, yeah, would have forced us to a very big revision of. On the other hand, the discovery of the Higgs is, it's disappointing for a theorist that would like some contradiction in between experiment and the established theories, right? So that you could find a new one. That's a very selfish point of view. On the other hand, I think the discovery of the Higgs tells us that we were in the right track thinking about quantum field. Our thoughts about quantum field theory were in the right track in the sense that we, from very general principles of quantum field theory, we expected something like the Higgs to exist. Perhaps not necessarily with exactly the property. The Higgs could have had the different properties, and it could have been, you know, technicolor. I mean, it could have been composite and so on. But there had to be something new to somehow explain the origin of electroweak symmetry breaking. There had to be something, and there was something. And so that's a beautiful confirmation with the general principles of the theory. And not only there was something, but the thing that was there was just the simplest possibility, just a weakly coupled Higgs boson.
Yeah, I think that, when we started talking about being where you are right now and talking a bit about Einstein and others that were working at a time where unification was a frustration. It's still a frustration of unifying, general relativity and quantum mechanics. It's something you're deeply involved with.
Right.
And there's some really beautiful things that you have done when thinking about something that is generally thought of as relativistic, which is black holes. You know, black holes should be described describing relativity is something that people intuitively can do, as difficult as it may be in some regards mathematically, where quantum mechanics does not feel so. Can you speak a little bit about where black holes can be thought of as a quantum system and where that plays out, not only as a relativistic?
Yeah. So black holes are a prediction of general relativity, and if you have a big concentration of matter, you can form. What happens is like a little region of the universe kind of collapses, and that is behind some horizon, and that's what we call the black hole. So it's in a region somehow inside that we cannot really see of the black hole that collapse. And this is well described by the laws of general relativity. And general relativity cannot describe exactly what happens when the universe completely collapses in the interior, so what we call the singularity. But it can describe the whole process up to that time when you have this collapse. Now, the interesting thing is when you combine these geometries of black holes with the principles of quantum mechanics or quantum field theory that we were discussing before, because that leads to the prediction that black holes emit radiation. They are hot. That was Hawking's famous prediction. And this is an effect which is not important for the black holes that are produced by astrophysics. So normal processes in our universe produce black holes that have masses of order solar mass or higher. And those black holes would in principle emit radiation if they were in an empty universe, but the temperature would be very, very tiny. So it would be about maybe about a millionth of a Kelvin. So very, very small temperature, and in particular smaller than the temperature of a CMB, so of the cosmic microwave background. So black holes in our universe are not emitting any, they are just absorbing. But if you had a small black hole, then this effect would be bigger. And But we are sort of studying this effect, not so much because we think it will happen in a black hole that we will see, but because it forces us to consider quantum mechanics and gravity at the same time, and it raises some paradoxes. So some and it's in attempting to resolve these paradoxes that they are useful. So they are useful as a theoretic thought experiment and theoretical laboratory that really forces us to think about quantum mechanics and gravity in some way and some new way. And that's where their main use is. And it is also, I mean, there are other processes that also force us to think about quantum mechanics and gravity, like the very early universe. But those are a little harder to think about. So the black hole is nice because you can sit far away from a black hole where space-time is, let's say, well-defined and not fluctuating, not expanding, not doing anything funny. And the only thing that is doing something funny is the black hole. So it's a bit like we can call it the hydrogen atom of quantum gravity. So it's a simple system that exposes some of the principles or some of the features we would like to understand in general.
Can you explain one of the more interesting things that people can talk about are paradoxes? Can you talk about more an intuitive paradox that might in the universe that doesn't feel right?
So the history of this starts with a question that Wheeler was asking Bekenstein. He said, the second law of thermodynamics is an important law that entropy should increase. But what happens if I throw this entropy inside a black hole? It seems to disappear completely from view, from our universe. And so it seems that the black holes would not respect. If you have a black hole, you wouldn't respect the laws of thermodynamics in our universe. And Bekenstein thought about this and realized that when you throw something into the black hole, the area of the horizon increases. And it increases in such a way that it obeys some law that will look like the first law of thermodynamics if you assign an entropy to the horizon. So if you say that the entropy of a black hole is proportional to the geometric area of the horizon, then, and then when later Hawking discovered his effect of Hawking radiation, and then those two things together tell us that black holes behave like a thermal object. So this is surprising because the black hole classically is just one geometry. And on the other hand, when we think about some object at finite temperature, we imagine that the full microscopic description of the object is in terms of many degrees of freedom, that they're all moving, and together they give rise to the entropy, to the entropy or the temperature. So for example, if we have a gas in a box, and which is at some temperature, well, that gas consists of molecules that are all moving around and have many possible configurations, and they are so there is some sort of microscopic, if you wish, motion that gives rise to the temperature. And so this gave rise to the question of what is that microscopic motion for the case of black holes? It should be those building blocks, those molecules, if you wish, they would be molecules of space-time itself, because black holes are, these properties of black holes don't depend on the particular kind of matter that we have in our universe. So instead of having the standard model, we could have something else. We could have a universe without matter, with just gravity, and you could make a black hole with gravity waves, just purely with gravity waves. So it's really this entropy, the black hole, if it arises from some microscopic degrees of freedom, it should be the microscopic degrees of freedom that give rise to space-time itself. And kind of these results led to one idea that was important. Well, that it's important, which is that if you sit outside the black hole, you should be able to think of the black hole as some quantum system with many parts, many degrees of freedom, and those degrees of freedom moving would give rise to the entropy. And would allow you, in principle, to predict what comes out of the black hole, so that radiation that Hawking had found could not be completely random, but had to encode some information of what fell in. That was a hypothesis, and it's similar to, if you wish, the atomic hypothesis, about 150 years ago. So people assumed that there were atoms, and that these atoms, the motion of these atoms, gave rise to thermodynamic properties and roots of chemistry, etc. But no one had seen an atom, and it was only with later exploration that they had more evidence for the existence of these atoms.
Right. So this is an interesting way to think of it, is that you constantly have to think about thermodynamics. You have to think about the second law of thermodynamics. You have to think about entropy.
Yeah.
And assume that this is a constant in the universe. Like, we have to have certain things, whether you call them laws or call them principles, whatever that might be, and then try to figure out why it doesn't make sense that this behaves this way, and then fill in the blanks. Is that right? Is that a way to think about it?
Yeah, that's right. So we're thinking that, we're thinking the laws of thermodynamics are sort of hold and will not be violated. By the laws of gravity, whatever they are. And then that forces us to try to understand better the laws of gravity, or in particular quantum gravity.
The thing when we talk about whether it's, you know, quantum entanglement, or you talk about, time, yes, space-time, but thinking as a human about time as it relates to, you know, a thin horizon of a black hole or a wormhole that you worked on, there's a concept called that, like, maybe a thought experiment of called firewalls. Can you explain what this is and what you're feeling about whether this has been helpful in understanding?
Well, yeah. So I told you about this hypothesis that says that the black hole could be replaced by a quantum system, and there was a discussion somehow since the 70s whether this could be true or not. And Hawking was arguing that it could not be true because the information really should be lost. He was trying to argue. He made this argument. Then through some developments in string theory, there was more evidence that it is actually true. So there are some special configurations in string theory where you could actually find these degrees of freedom and give them some concrete descriptions through these holographic ideas and so on for quantum gravity. I won't discuss them in great detail. But then people returned to this paradox of Hawking and rephrased it in terms of... And the problem, the tension between these two ideas is somehow that you could assume you have this... you could assume this quantum description... But it was hard to square that with the idea that the horizon of a black hole would be completely smooth. So Hawking assumed that and then seemed to argue that the information had to be lost. Through all these results in string theory, it looked like information wasn't lost. But some authors have proposed that the correct interpretation is that the horizon of a black hole should not be smooth. There should be some kind of firewall at the horizon of a black hole, at least for certain kinds of black holes, for a black hole that has been evaporating for a long time.
A firewall meaning?
By a firewall would be that the singularity would not be, that there would be a singularity at the horizon and not behind the horizon, just some distance into the black hole or some time into the black hole. They propose this as a kind of resolution of this tension. And this motivated a lot of further research and trying to understand what was going on. But currently, this is not the favored resolution. So there were some further developments, and especially last year, there were some interesting ideas. And, so that's not the way we think this is resolved. But actually, perhaps the most interesting result is that we should think of the interior of those black holes as being described not by this black hole degrees of freedom that give rise to the entropy of the black hole, but in terms of the radiation. So even though the radiation is far away, it is in a very complex quantum state. And the idea is that the radiation is describing the interior in the sense that if you had some information in the interior and you act in a very complicated way on the radiation, you could extract it. And there is, yeah, so it's a very interesting picture. So it makes somehow the connection between quantum mechanics and space-time a little more complicated, but interesting also. And we are currently trying to understand this better. There is some evidence that this is true, and there is some role that certain kinds of wormholes play in justifying this picture and so on.
This is a lot of work you're doing, right? This is where you step into all of this, but this is
the area where I'm working on, and well, several other people are working on. I mean, I think the main idea a couple of years, well, year and a half ago, was an idea by Jeff Pennington, a graduate student at the time at Stanford, and also by Al Murray, who's a member here at the Institute, and Engelhardt, who's also a young assistant professor at MIT, Marolf, who's at Santa Barbara, and Maxfield, also a young person. So, they realized this, essentially this picture that the interior should be part of the radiation that we were discussing. And then other people, including myself, followed up on this and tried to justify it better.
You mentioned other people and collaborations, and I think of your work as something that can be done in a way in isolation, but there are collaborations too, I suppose. I mean, you talk about some interesting figures that many people know. I mean, this started a lot with some ideas of Hawking.
Yeah.
Did you know Hawking? Did you work with
him? Yeah, I did work with him, but I think part of what happens when people describe it, and as I have described it here, we mention a few people because they're the people that are known. And I think all this happened within a community, and there were many, many other people who worked on the subject. And I think sometimes we simplify the history, but collaboration, I think it's crucial. It is, we work here. We have a large group of people and postdocs and graduate students, and we constantly have discussions, and those are very important. And also there are discussions with people in other institutions. It's happening within a community, and these results of last year were part of a general effort by many people of trying to connect ideas of quantum information, entropy, and so on, quantum entropy, and space-time, ideas of space-time.
It's interesting how you almost seemed, I wouldn't say frustrated, but like a little, the simplification of looking at individual sort of stars in the field, in a sense. And you talked about when you were young, you weren't reading popular accounts of physics, that these books may not existed. But in some regard, this has served as an inspiration to people that there are that there are people that, attract, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Did that play any role in your life at all? I mean, is there somebody you wanted to work with or that inspired you in that way as a sort of superstar in a field?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I think the superstar in the field when I entered was Edward Witten.
Oh,
also here,
really? Man, he's like you, one of these people that I'm scared to talk to because every word seems so brilliant, right?
Yeah. So certainly he's been super influential in our field and the field of
Do you ever find that something like, if you talk about string theory, do you ever find that incredibly intelligent leaders can be wrong, and it's disappointing in a sense? That, like we talked about maybe mathematical, supersymmetry or something, maybe wrong. As individuals, I'm certainly attracted to wanting to work with the smartest guy in the room. It's, do you ever feel this? I got to pull myself away from this, regardless of the intelligence of the figure.
Well, I mean, there is in science an incentive for younger people to prove that the other ones are wrong. So I think there is some correction mechanism.
Is that a good thing?
Well, that's a good thing. I mean, that's how science works. And if you can prove that some very popular idea was wrong, that's great. Now, string theory is a theory. So it's a set of mathematical formulas. The mathematical formulas are not wrong. Well, they might be wrong, but they are not inconsistent, and they seem to be, many relationships between them are correct, that were conjectured are correct and are proven more and more. So as a theory, it seems to be a theory that makes sense. There is a question of whether it's the theory that describes reality, which is some other question.
Isn't that the big question, though? Is there
Well, of course, it's a big question, but and it's a very important question. So yeah, I mean, it's just a theory, as any theory in physics, it can be wrong. Many theories. Well, yeah.
Well, I always.
Yeah, in physics we have provisional theories. Now, I mean, probably none of the theories we know today in physics will be correct, completely correct. There will be something that goes beyond. And string theory, we should think of it. So the minimal way you should think about string theory is that it's a toy model for quantum gravity. So we had this problem of understanding the very basic building blocks of gravity. String theory gives us some idea of what they are. And it gives us some calculable model. Now, quantum gravity might be different. Maybe string theory is just some corner. Maybe it's all of it. We don't know that.
It's interesting to think of where physics is right now and think of the constraints that you might... people see, and really smart, good physicists, not just, consider the constraints of what is physics versus what is mathematics and what is philosophy in ways that are maybe not the way Popper would describe how we should view physics. What constraints are there? Is our universe, the work in our universe, a constraint? Or can we look towards how something might work in a multiverse or with the mini worlds hypothesis? You have to be able to envision an experiment that could happen. What constraints do you work under, whether it's mathematical constraints or physical constraints, in describing what physics is now?
I should say that this area of physics of trying to find the fundamental laws, it's mostly guided by consistency, by mathematical consistency. You have to come up with something that is self-consistent, and then we will also would have to describe. I mean, it should also be consistent with the real world. So you could come up with some mathematical rules which looks self-consistent. An example of this is the Hartle-Hawking wave function of the universe, for example. It's a rule that this looks good from the gravity point of view, but it's actually not consistent with our experience somehow. So it seems to contradict phenomenology, or just gives the wrong prediction for our universe. They try to fix it up, but I'm not convinced about the fix up. I mean, maybe there is some way to fixing it up. I personally feel there should be a way to fixing it up. But it's an example of something that is a beautiful idea that does not look consistent with our universe in a very general way. It basically predicts like an empty universe, so an universe with no observer in it. So that's how we are guided. I mean, there is, and then someone comes up, we should come up with some other idea for defining how to do quantum mechanics in the universe, and people are exploring different ideas. I should say they are not as beautiful as the Hartle-Hawking wave, but they have the advantage of at least being consistent with what we see. But yeah, string theory is a more detailed model of how the quantum mechanics of gravity works. It's also intimately connected with particle physics. So there are some types of strings that have already been discovered. So the strings of QCD that appear when you have gauge fields, or the type of gluons, let's say, the type of fields that mediate the strong interactions. And those look like they should be strings that live in a certain highly curved five-dimensional space. And So that's a type of string that, that's a type of connection that, well, many of us have been exploring between sort of particle physics and strings, which is orthogonal to quantum gravity at first sight, but it involves some quantum gravity in very special universes.
How often do you have an experience where you get completely shaken up, right? As you know, you work for many years on trying to, you know, and successfully being able to extend string theory to explain new phenomena in the universe, and there's incredible mathematical consistency. So, do you ever get completely shaken up where you just want to clear the board and start looking at the universe in a different way?
Well, yeah, sometimes we... Yeah, so sometimes people propose, sometimes there are developments that can question the way you were thinking about it. For example, recently, there is the following question. So whether all the constants of nature are completely fixed or not, or maybe there is a small number of choices or not. Or maybe it should phrase it differently as saying, is there a unique theory or are there many possible theories? And people have recently suggested in certain toy models of two-dimensional gravity that a useful way to think about those gravity theories is by thinking that the gravity, or let's say a black hole, is not dual to just one quantum system, but to an average of quantum systems. So that the geometry does not give you the answer of what happens in one particular quantum system, but in an average where you don't know exactly what the particular laws that you have are. It's kind of thermodynamic average in some way, but not exactly thermodynamics. It's an average over possible descriptions. And so that's, I think, an interesting idea that, was thought about a bit in the late 80s, but was abandoned at the time, and now it's kind of resurrected. And
so you dig up old papers again and circle new things and say, maybe that wasn't so...
Well, I mean, I certainly, before this development, I always had the idea that there would be basically one theory, and the quantum system that describes a black hole is one quantum system, but this certainly questioning that. And in a nice way, because you can do some calculations that you couldn't do before. So there is some truth to that.
What if we look at something that is also completely different? What have you looked at Stephen Wolfram's new work on unification?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Give me your thoughts.
I mean, he has this idea of that is based on maybe cellular automata or complexity from logic and so on. So it's very abstract. I think one could think about it, and there are some developments also from some other points of view that suggest something of this kind. But I think these are ideas that, they might or might not be true, but they haven't had the power of explaining what some aspect of quantum gravity. Let's say they haven't given rise to an explanation, let's say, for black hole entropy or any phenomenon that we would like to at least conceptually understand. So like a conceptual application. So normally you can... say, I think that the fundamental theory should describe these concepts and so on, and that's good. But you would like that to see that those concepts explain some feature, right? And that's what is missing. But it's a new idea. Maybe they'll find some application. And so people have different ideas of quantum gravity. Sometimes they seem incompatible with each other, and sometimes in the later developments show that there is some element that was reasonable and might be part of the new of the description, and this has happened with other ideas in the past. So for example, there were some people that were thinking about quantum gravity in terms of some sort of building blocks that were like tetrahedra, and you put them all together and so on. And they found some interesting mathematics about putting together this tetrahedra, and that there were sort of critical points, or what we call phase transitions, or critical points where you build very complicated structures out of this tetrahedron you could describe mathematically in a nice way. And yeah, they found this, but it didn't have the properties that you expect for a four-dimensional space. And it was later understood that those should be interpreted as two-dimensional spaces, as describing dynamics near a black hole, and that this tetrahedra had nothing to do with the shape of the actual final space. But and then that mathematics and those developments could be used for thinking about certain two-dimensional black holes.
Sorry.
Well, that's an example of some theory that, well, you could say, oh, no, this must be wrong, but then it is right with some suitable interpretation. Well, this might happen here, or well, it might be that it's correct in the original interpretation.
Something is really attractive to people about, well, there are a few things that people who aren't deep in the field that maybe end up deep in the field is, what's exciting is that you can take these thought experiments. The idea of a thought experiment that you explore then mathematically and maybe experimentally is extremely exciting and attractive to a lot of people. Is that often still how you start? I mean, is it, you know, I think of, you know, certainly Einstein as someone who started with what ends up seeming like a fairly basic thought experiment that ended up being relativity and this important thing. Is this still something you think inspires young people in science and even professionals?
Well, I think it's much better when you have actual experiments. So I think the true inspiration for physics are actual experiments. Thought experiments are useful for developing mathematical ideas or for questioning basic principles, and certainly were very useful for Einstein. So I don't know. Actual experiments like the Michelson-Morley experiment and so on were also very important. The problem is in the field of quantum gravity, the energy scales or these effects, the quantum effects in gravity are very, very small. So it's hard to do experiments right now. So all we can do is thought experiments.
Yeah.
And with the hope that at some point we'll be able to connect them with actual experiments.
So the thought experiment is not only a thought experiment about something that the way the universe may work, but you're now thinking of how that could potentially, there could potentially be an experiment for such a thing when it's almost unimaginable right now at these scales.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the best hope for an actual contact with experiments comes through cosmology, because in cosmology, when the universe was very small, we are really exploring we're in a regime where quantum effects were important. And in fact, quantum effects connected to gravity are important for describing the origin of the fluctuations that created structure in the universe. So if the universe was perfectly homogeneous, then it would continue to be perfectly homogeneous in the future. So the average density of the universe is one atom per cubic meter, and the density here on Earth is much bigger. and the question, one question was what created some initial inhomogeneities. So the universe was kind of homogeneous, but it had some small inhomogeneities that some regions where there was a little bit more density, more matter, and those regions collapse and form planets, galaxies, etc., stars, galaxies, etc. And the current theory for how they were created relies on the theory of inflation that says, and during that, so some period of rapid expansion, and there were quantum effects during that period that created some fluctuations. So the fact that the universe was not classical at the time, that there were quantum mechanical effects, is important for understanding a feature of our current universe. And that's the best explanation we have of this of the origin of structure. So that's an example. Those fluctuations, fortunately, we can describe simply using quantum fields in a curved universe, and they don't involve quantum gravity in a very serious way. But they involve quantum gravity in a calculable way, and that's very nice, and one can do this calculation. But it could be that there are some even further aspects of the universe earlier on where quantum gravity effects were higher, and then they would depend on some more details of the theory.
Yes, there's still something to fill in, right? I guess that's the interesting thing is that...
Yeah. So, for example, the type of question is where... So there's this theory of inflation, but we don't understand where the details of this inflationary phase came from. And maybe one could explain that by understanding better quantum gravity.
So there may not have always been inflation.
Well, inflation is currently the favored theory for explaining some aspects of our universe. There are people who suggest other theories, but I think those theories are worse than inflation. They are less predictive and less mathematically well-defined. Inflation is not perfectly well-defined, but it's better defined than the other candidates. I don't know. Maybe someone will come up with another candidate that is as well-defined as inflation. Yeah, inflation is certainly the dominant paradigm, but it might not. Yeah, you might find something else. So.
Now, I'm going to step away from physics, even though physics sort of surrounds everything in conversation, because I still, we're trying to understand the physical universe. But how do you step away and, look at, real interactions and things that we do in regular life? Mm-hmm. As separate from looking at these completely different scales, incredibly small and incredibly large.
Right.
How do you live life and with an understanding of the universe that is sort of different than what others do, or does it make absolutely no difference? And the day job is figuring out something esoteric in mathematics.
I think in my mind is more like that. Yeah, something. My day job is the.
you
think about the universe, and then my.
You deal with relationships, you deal with trying to figure out the way.
You read with relationship, you deal with your children.
Exactly.
And so that's what I do outside of physics.
You have children?
Yes, we have three.
Yeah, I have two kids myself. How interested are they in the work?
They're not too interested. Yeah, they have very mild interest. That they're afraid of being interested because they fear that I will start talking too much about it. And then,
oh my god!
Before to hear it.
This is so true that I get a lot from my kids. No, I don't. I ask a question. You didn't. It should have been one sentence. We don't. To understand beyond that, so then they just stop asking me after a while. But you have to understand: is there something that you learn from them that shapes the way you at least do work, whether it's an idea in work?
Well, the importance of short answers, perhaps.
Short answers. No, seriously, though, is that true? Like, did your explanation for things become more concise because you have to be more concise with your kids?
Yeah, I mean, one should always try. Yeah. I think trying to be concise and short is good. And simple, and basic.
So one thing about your job is you don't have to teach. Is that right?
That's a peculiarity of the job here at the Institute. I mean, most people who do research in our area also teach at the university.
How do you feel about that? Do you ever do you like teaching?
I like teaching, but some effort. I prefer to do research, but teaching also is nice.
Do you see a generational change? I mean, you're not doing teaching, so but you're still dealing with postdocs and people. Do you see a generational change in how people view physics? It's something others.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are, well, of course, there are different topics that become more important, and there are developments in physics. Like, for example, now there is an important focus on gravity. I think much on experimental gravity through the discovery of gravity waves, black
holes. Right, we actually have some evidence now. You know, there was an experiment.
Yeah, there are experiments that are probing some aspects of black holes, or even, well, classical general relativity, and so that's a growing area, and more people are interested in this area than when I.
There's also something that I think is happening that may not make its way to the level that you are, but there seems to be a more fundamental, not completely fundamental in a physics sense, but a more fundamental understanding in biology lately. You know, you understand a genome, and we understand individual base pairs. There seems to be a kind of crosstalk that either is starting to happen or maybe should happen, I think, that I'm noticing. Is this something that, you know, do you read?
Well, okay, I guess your question is about biology and physics. And yeah, of course there are. Yeah. Well, I mean, there almost all physics departments have some biophysics program, and exactly what that is depends on the place. And yeah, applying some physics ideas to problems in biology. I don't see a relationship between quantum gravity and biology.
What about quantum mechanics in general?
Well, of course, quantum mechanics is related to chemistry, and chemistry is important for biology, so that's important. But I think perhaps the point of contact might be understanding better how biological systems process information. And so now I think in many areas of physics, people are thinking more about information and how how information flows in the system, and so there are some people who think about how information constrains biological systems. So because they have to process information, they have to encode it, they have to decode it. There is noise. If you think about it this way, then there could be some lessons from physics that you can apply. For example, Bill Bialek, who's here at the university, works in this area. It's very interesting. That's perhaps it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that way. That's fascinating. So, you know, you're taking, at least in an inspirational sense, I wonder if it's a physical sense. You know, we talked about black holes. We talked about information coming in and out. Mm-hmm. We talked about firewalls. You know, in biology, we think about neuroscience. We think of synapse. We try to think of what is information and how it's taken. It's at least interesting on a sort of inspirational level to be able to connect things, even if it's not connecting it physically yet. That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess the DNA stores information, and the various chemical reactions in the cell, they are processing some chemical signals that the cell is finding, and you know, they have to do that, and how all of that, I think, it's probably constrained by the loss of information that the cell has to learn what the environment is. It has to, some people propose that evolution itself is a learning process and should be tried to understood from that point of view.
Do you think about technology still? You talked about as a child thinking about technology. Yeah. Do you think about technology such as quantum computers?
Do you think about quantum? A little bit. I mean, I follow it with some distance. I mean, that's probably the closest aspect. I mean, a little bit, not too much. There are some people who are trying to realize very strongly interacting systems in a quantum computer, and that's somehow a bit connected to the black hole question. So you could imagine simulating you could imagine a quantum computer that performs a very complicated calculation that could be described in terms of a black hole or something similar. Not the four-dimensional black hole, but perhaps some certain very simple two-dimensional black holes. And that's, I think, a very interesting area.
Yeah, that's something that you can take apart and touch. you know, which I'm incredibly interested in it and know nothing. I did something. There's something. Politics that nobody really understands things, so they have people like me who don't understand things to try to bridge it a little bit. So I give it. I found myself giving a congressional testimony about quantum computing for funding by the government. I'm sitting there and it occurred to me halfway, how could they possibly have asked me to do this? Right? What do I know? But it, you know, if you don't just take slightly more than a politician, you're probably better off.
Right.
But I am interested in this. I'm pushing, and I don't mean to, but I kind of do. What inspires you outside of just, digging into the deep, deep fundamentals of the universe? And maybe you look from cosmology to, two different types of quantum systems and strings, the smallest. Do you read science fiction? Do you like movies? What do you do outside that, you know?
Outside I'm mostly with my family and, do the things that we normally do with our kids. And I think in research and so on, I'm inspired by trying to find the truth, trying to find new ideas and, trying to make progress.
Where do you think a general understanding from the public goes so wrong that you wish you could correct, either through, better popularizers or is there something in general says they're missing it entirely?
Well, I think the general public has some idea, and I think the general understanding becomes better with time. I think sometimes there is a tendency in perhaps in the media to sensationalize, to make stronger claims about results than they actually are and so on.
You're making some pretty strong claims. I mean, it's hard for the media to make a stronger claim than the stuff you work on, but it may be easier to communicate some, time travel or what is a wormhole.
And that's right. Yeah, for example, time travel is something that everyone talks about, and there are many science fiction authors talking about people traveling back in time and so on.
But, so back in time is impossible, right? I mean, do you believe this?
Yes. So that's, for example, something that the general public doesn't appreciate how impossible it is or how difficult it is, or traveling faster than light, for example. That's also something that, people think, they'll invent something and we will be able to travel faster than light. But that's also extremely difficult and inconsistent with the current laws of physics.
Okay, so I'm kind of getting it. There are things that are kind of true that come out. There's terminology that comes out of what you do. And it connects to something that was fictional and it excites us. Right? So quantum teleportation, this is something, but it's not macro in the human scale that we're there.
Quantum teleportation, it is possible. That's to teleport a person would be exceedingly difficult, but it is in principle possible. What is not possible is instant teleportation. In the movies, you have instant teleportation, which means that you go from one place to another immediately, faster than the speed of light. That is not possible, even with quantum teleportation.
Can you explain why quantum entanglement is not faster than the speed of light?
Yeah. So quantum entanglement is some correlation that exists between the two systems, but you cannot send information with entanglement. So you cannot send it instantly. You can send something using teleportation, and you can send quantum bits using entanglement, but in order to send them, you have to send some classical bits. So what quantum teleportation does is it simplifies the task of sending the qubit. If you have some prior entanglement, then you only need to send classical bits as opposed to qubits. And classical bits are easier to send. I guess now we can send classical bits through the internet. The qubits, we very hard to send qubits. And quantum teleportation allows you to send those qubits. But you have to send the classical bits, and the time it takes for you to recover the qubits in the other side has to do with the time it takes light to travel from one to the other.
Yeah. Well, I won't take up much.
Yeah, I think perhaps this issue of how difficult it is to travel faster than light is one of the main things that the science fiction readers have wrong, at least in what respects to physics and space-time and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's always disappointing to us. However, the interesting thing is what is possible. Sometimes a technology that doesn't reach fundamental physics. I mean, AI is something that's happening. Quantum computing has different potentials that are exciting, right? There are these things
But you could have the perfect quantum computer and you will not travel faster than light. So. But you will be able to do other things.
If we get close to the speed of light, we'll be able to do some pretty cool things. So we need not get the whole way to the speed of light.
Yeah, that's right. Something that is true is that you can travel to the future. So you can, in the sense that you can...
Well, we do it, right?
We're moving into the future, but you can travel faster. So you can, by moving fast, you can age less and you can arrive to the future younger. So in that sense, you can do that.
And I guess in a small sense, we've done that, right? I mean, you go to the space station, you're going slightly.
A very accurate clock could detect it. So.
Right. And I mean, we're so early in things like this that but it's still happening. It's a proven thing. That's actually, we actually have experimental evidence that we can do time travel.
To the future.
Yes. Okay, we'll give up the past. Going into that. We'll read inaccurate historical books about what the past was like and try to interpret which one was right and not actually be able to go there. I want to end this talk. It occurs to me that certainly there aren't going to be millions of people that are going to be working on theoretical physics to the level that you are, right? Or working in it at all.
Right.
Why would you do a podcast like this? Or you've done a lot of, you've done other podcasts, you've done media appearances, you've done talks. Why do it if the audience, likely won't work in the space and, there may not be a direct connection to their life?
I think some of these questions of what space-time is and so on interest people, and I hope that whoever is listening to the podcast finds it interesting. And of course, when people do science and research, they try to make progress, but then it's something that is a common good for the whole society to understand, right? So now we have a picture of the universe that was built over many generations of researchers and people who did experiments and theories and so on. And that is a very important cultural good.
Yeah, I completely agree. And thank you for doing this.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. It's good to meet you.
Yeah, well, nice talking to you.
Great. Thanks so much.
Sure. Yeah.